This is an ABC podcast.
This is ABC Australia Wide on ABC Radio.
Today on Australia Wide, the states failed to get the federal government to discuss emissions reduction at COAG today. As analysts warn, the policy vacuum is stalling investment in the electricity sector.
They just want to know how to get out of Australia. They simply can't believe just how bad things have got in Australia. They're just bewildered. Everybody is.
The ACCC takes a closer look at insurance premiums in the north to work out why they are so high, and moves are afoot to formally acknowledge a dark chapter in Australia's history. I'm Michelle Crowther, and this is Australia Wide. Well, today, New South Wales State Energy Minister Don Harwin went into a COAG meeting in Adelaide calling for an end to our nation's so-called climate wars. In a move that distances New South Wales LNP from its federal counterparts, he accompanied the call with a strongly worded piece in the Australian Financial Review saying that policy uncertainty was putting billions of dollars worth of investment at risk. This was the outcome.
We need a circuit breaker, and there was an opportunity to progress it today. But as a sign of how out of touch they are, they wouldn't let us have the discussion.
For the first time, Liberal and Labor states lined up together with the same message. This is Queensland Energy Minister Anthony Lynham.
Every state was in unison regarding climate change. Climate change is real. Australia, as a nation, has to do something about climate change. Queensland and the states want to address climate change, but we're simply blocked by this federal government.
Minister, just to be clear, every single state wanted the emissions obligation.
Every single state was in unison regarding emissions.
That's Queensland Energy Minister Anthony Lynham. Well, Federal Energy Minister Angus Taylor says he is delighted at the outcome of today's talks.
We achieved everything we wanted to from the COAG Energy Council. And in particular, we've agreed on implementation of the retailer reliability obligation from the 1st of July next year. This is a crucial reform for every Australian. What it means is retailers now are accountable to ensure there's enough supply in the market years ahead of time to keep prices down and to keep the lights on and to keep Australians in work in those energy-intensive industries that are so crucial to our economy.
Federal Energy Minister Angus Taylor speaking today after the COAG meeting in Adelaide. Well, how significant is this, where states are lining up against the federal government with divergences in views about how to take our energy policy forward? Dr. John Hewson is a former Liberal leader and now with ANU's Crawford School, and I put the question to him.
Now, look, I think it exposes the farce that is the federal coalition's energy policy or lack of energy policy. I mean, to just keep wandering around the country saying, I'm going to get electricity prices down, without any policy to do that, and ignoring the other dimension, the link between energy policy and emissions reduction and the Paris commitments, I think is grossly irresponsible. And I saw that the attempt of the New South Wales Minister today to raise that issue and get it debated, blocked off by Angus Taylor, who is monumentally out of touch with reality, and about 75% of the community in Australia that wants, in just about every poll and every survey, that wants decisive action on climate change led by government.
Would you agree that we can't get energy prices down if we can't get investors, and we can't get investors without policy certainty, so we're a bit stuck?
The tragedy of the climate wars of the last couple of decades is that, A, we don't have an energy policy, and B, we do have the natural resources in wind and solar and the technologies to exploit them to produce the lowest cost baseload solar thermal, for example, in the world, a project that I've been associated with, for example. But I'm staggered that, you know, it's difficult to get these things off the drawing board because there is no certainty, there's no clear direction, there's no framework within which people can responsibly operate and make those sort of longer-term investment decisions. So the country loses out. We pay high prices for electricity, and we see a loss of jobs and billions of dollars of investment because of that lack of certainty.
So if we don't see any resolution on a federal level with energy policy, what do you see the states doing in the medium to short term, short to medium term?
Well, I think the states can move and are moving as fast as they can in their own areas with their own within their own opportunities and constraints. And look, I was fascinated in the US, for example, when Trump said, "I'm not going to sign Paris," and the states and major cities and a large number of the business leaders all said, "Well, don't worry about that. We'll just move anyway." You know, and that's what's happening in Australia. The government has been left behind. Individual households have been putting solar panels on their roof. The most intensive application of rooftop solar in the world per capita. We've seen businesses now start to break out and call for change. BHP even has called for a price on carbon. You know, they're moving out of coal. You're seeing a whole lot of activity beyond government. Government's, you know, late into the game and way behind the pace. They are the laggards in this process.
Well, Dr. John Hewson is former Liberal leader and now with ANU's Crawford School. So how do today's developments play out if the states are out of step with the federal government? Danny Price is Managing Director of Frontier Economics. He's been working on national energy markets for 30 years.
Well, obviously they're way more isolated than they were this morning. And I think Don Harwin's exactly right. He's characterised the problem perfectly. We've been saying for a very long time the reason why we're in this energy crisis is because of lack of investment, and the lack of investment is to do with policy ineptitude and uncertainty. So Don Harwin's diagnosed the problem correctly. Unfortunately, the solution is passed now. I don't think that carbon pricing is ever going to work, simply because the government has done such harm to the reputation of governments and their ability to be able to kind of stick to this arrangement. Because remember, you're asking people to make investments for 20, 30 years. That is, that governments will stick to a plan for 20 or 30 years. And what Australia has demonstrated is that they can't stick to a plan within a week. And carbon pricing really requires to be, you know, fairly stable over time, and it's not going to be.
It's interesting that you say that the time for a price on carbon has changed, because we're still seeing industry by the day calling out for that price on carbon. So why is industry still making that call if there's still not going to be any certainty?
Because they've got nothing else to sort of grab onto. There's no other agenda for any other change. Because you know they understand that that has been the root cause of these problems, and so they just figure that would fix the problem up. But I know from conversations with all of them, they would still remain completely unconvinced. But they don't have any other option, so they're just grabbing on to what they think is achievable.
So where does that leave, for example, $26 billion of potential investment in large-scale renewable projects in New South Wales? Where does that leave those projects now?
Well, if nothing changes, what will happen is that increasingly the taxpayer will have to pay for all of those investments. And, in fact, that's what's happening right across Australia already. So Victoria, Queensland, the ACT, South Australia, now even New South Wales state governments are sponsoring these investments. Virtually all new generation investment has been paid for by the taxpayer. They're not being paid by the private sector on a sort of a private sector risk-taking basis. That's just stopped. So those projects will probably go ahead very expensively and sponsored by the taxpayer.
Seeing responsibility for all of this moving back to the states, tell me a little bit about how that's unfolded over the last 10 years.
Well, up until about 10 years ago, virtually every single power station that was built by the private sector, with them bearing all the costs and risks. In the last 5 years in particular, virtually all the power stations are now being sponsored by the state. It's been a radical change, and that's because we need new capacity. The national electricity market was never broken in the way that the government characterised it. It was broken by bad policy. For 15 years, the national market worked perfectly well in shutting down plants and replacing them, but it can't do that now because the extreme uncertainty for investors. And so it's just been this massive shift from the private sector bearing the risk to the public sector bearing the risk. the coalition has by design ruined the market. Because what they've tried to do is shift the blame for their own policy ineptitude to scapegoat the industry. And so the industry is, you know, kind of really retreating very, very quickly.
Danny Price is the Managing Director of Frontier Economics, talking about some of those developments at COAG today.
We are one.
Every Aussie has a story about the ABC. Just ask Warwick Thornton.
ABC is incredibly good for Australia because it is ours and it is us and it is who we are as a country. And it's changed as the country's changed. ABC has been part of my life for all of my life. It is a voice that can't be played with.
Share your stories at abc.net.au/yours.
ABC, it's yours.
You are listening to Australia Wide and I'm Michelle Crowther, filling in for Sinead Mangan. In other news around Australia today, the Australian Bureau of Statistics figures show that more people in Tasmania are dying of drug overdoses than in car crashes. About one person a week is dying from a drug overdose in that state. In Queensland, prison guards have walked off the job at Woodford Correctional Centre today after an inmate attacked one of their colleagues and left him with serious facial injuries. The dispute is being heard in the Queensland Industrial Relations Commission. And a Western Australian man who owes hundreds of thousands of dollars in unpaid rates and legal fees has had his house seized. Wayne Glue does not believe that councils have the right to charge rates, but constitutional law professor Anne Toomey says he is wrong. Well, it's said that everything's bigger in Northern Australia, the size of the cattle, the hats, the rainfall figures, and now the insurance premiums. The Australian Competition and Consumer Commission has been investigating why insurance is so high. And in its report on the issue, the ACCC has made 28 recommendations saying government needs to intervene. Vanessa Mills reports.
Not only are insurance premiums considerably higher in Northern Australia, they've risen at a faster rate, shooting up 130% in 10 years compared to 50% in Southern Australia. ACCC Deputy Chair Delia Rickard.
And we're seeing in terms of the costs that people are paying. In Northern Western Australia, the average premium is around $3,500. In North Queensland, $2,400. NT, $2,200. Whereby the rest of Australia, it's about $1,300.
That Northern Western Australia pays the highest premiums in the nation doesn't surprise Broome's Frankie O'Connor, who's owned a home for 6 years in the tourist town.
This year our premium went up by about 42%, which was a pretty big hike. In the previous years, our premium had gone up each year by around 10 to 13%. So it's quite a lot to go up each year. I did speak to the insurance company a couple of days ago and they mentioned that primarily the reason for this big increase was due to the increased cyclone risk as a result of the last year's wet season, even though we didn't have any claims ourselves.
The ACCC found extreme weather and the cost of servicing the North partly to blame, but companies also had unfair contract terms and set premiums at an individual address rather than an area. Delia Rickard.
When you pull the risk, it sort of equalises out the prices a bit. Once you go down to individual addresses, it can result in some very sharp price increases for individuals. And that's one of the reasons why we have seen some people have really exorbitantly high insurance bills.
It's really frustrating because I'm not prepared to be without this kind of insurance. I know that some people do reach the point where they can't afford it or they choose not to insure. Shopping around has become a pretty much an annual exercise for us, which again is quite frustrating because it can be very time consuming and hard to sort of work out the comparisons between insurance policies. One time I did put in identical criteria to a different street in a different suburbs and found that policy was actually going to be even more expensive.
Frankie O'Connor. The inquiry found stamp duty paid on home, contents and strata insurance in Northern Australia increased by $55 million in the past 10 years to $79 million. Insurance Council of Australia Campbell Fuller thinks abolishing stamp duty isn't the answer.
One of the ACCC recommendations was that if a states and territories don't abolish these stamp duties, that the money collected from the stamp duties be used for mitigation, resilience and other kinds of measures. Now, prima facie, that sounds like a sensible suggestion, but in fact, that actually sends the wrong message, because those kind of community-wide mitigation and protection measures are enjoyed by the entire community, and yet they'd be funded only by people who are protecting their properties against the financial risk through insurance.
I'm really glad that there is an inquiry, and I think the fact that there's an inquiry shows that there is something to be investigated and hopefully some changes to come out of that. I'm following it with interest. I put in the submission myself, and I've read part of the preliminary report. And one of the findings in the latest report was that insurance companies do actually, one of the factors for their premiums is that they do increase the premium if they perceive the risk is high and they want to detract people from buying their policies or keeping their policies. So, you know, I guess that's part of why the insurance has gone up this year so much, that they actually want to reduce their risk exposure by reducing the number of customers they have.
Basically getting you out of their business.
Yeah, exactly. And because we have so few companies that will insure in this region or above the 26th parallel, then it makes it hard to find affordable insurance because there's not many choices.
Frankie O'Connor. The inquiry, which had 280 submissions and 8 public forums, found insurers were actively deterring customers and limiting their company's exposure by raising premiums. And this was leading to soft competition above the Tropic of Capricorn. Delia Rickard.
We think there's a lot more work that needs to be done. And that, in fact, more significant interventions are needed if insurance is to be accessible and affordable in Northern Australia. And so we're going to look at how people around, countries and areas around the world have tried to deal with that problem. And we're looking at the reinsurance pooling that some have done. Others have had levies that have gone right across the population so that they could spread the costs a bit more. Some have involved government guarantees. Some have involved not-for-profit mutual insurers. So we're going to look what's worked, what hasn't, what combination of those may or may not be suitable to try to think about applying in Northern Australia.
And thank you to Vanessa Mills in Broome for that report.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
Well, moves are underway to formally acknowledge a dark chapter in Australia's history. Between 1908 and 1919, hundreds of Aboriginal people were removed from their homelands across Western Australia, and they were taken to lock hospitals on islands off the state's coast for treatment for suspected venereal diseases. Many never returned home. Karen Mitchell-Moore has this story.
For generations, Aboriginal people across Western Australia didn't talk about the islands. It was too traumatic. Kathleen Muslin was told a story by one elder in Carnarvon, the remote West Australian town closest to the Bernier and Dorey Islands.
When she was a little girl, she would overhear the older ladies speaking about their loved ones on the islands. And when she would ask about it, they would tell her, "No, you're not allowed to talk about it. You had to cover your eyes and just point over there," out of respect for the all the Aboriginal people that were taken there.
Ms. Muslin's great-grandmother was among the hundreds taken to the islands, and the pain is still very real today.
It's important not only for myself, but it's important for my children and grandchildren to know what happened to their ancestor and to all the other Aboriginal people. And it's important for other families because of the trauma and the hurt that we have suffered, knowing what happened to our ancestors and the horrific things that were done to them.
She's leading a push with other members of the Aboriginal community in Carnarvon, along with academics, to gain wider acknowledgement of the Lock Hospital history. That history is that hundreds of men, women and children suspected, often wrongly, of having venereal diseases were transported to the islands, often in chains. lock hospitals were de facto prisons, in some cases hundreds of kilometres away from their homelands. On the islands, they had no contact with their families back home and were subjected to experimental treatments. More than 100 people died on the islands and are buried in unmarked graves. A ceremony will be held in early January to mark 100 years to the day since the hospitals were closed and the last patient removed from the islands. The West Australian Government says it's the first in Australia to formally recognise the history and is funding a memorial statue at the site. Alana McTiernan is the Minister for Regional Development and says the history hadn't emerged until recently.
This is a truly disgraceful story. This is part of our story. We've got to be grown up. We've got to acknowledge what happened if we as a community are to move forward.
Archaeologist Jade Purvin is one of the academics who has been piecing together the history from the evidence. The clues point to a harsh life.
We know that the lock hospitals were set up after the 1905 Aboriginal Act, which was where they didn't want supposed diseases that Aboriginal people had passed on to the Europeans. We know with hindsight that it was likely that a lot of the Aboriginal people didn't have any of the diseases. In this case, it was venereal diseases or syphilis, and that they were probably placed on there for other reasons, and it was a very racially based removal.
Elder Bob Dorey wants the wider Australian public to know the story.
I would like them to know everything about them, what happened, you know, what happened over there and what happened back here, and see, it's our story, you know. It's we've learnt everybody else's story in school, but nothing like this.
Carnarvon Elder Bob Dorey ending Karen Mitchell-Moore's report.
This is ABC Australia Wide.
And I hope you're having a wonderful afternoon. Also having a wonderful afternoon, Bridget Fitzgerald. Evening.
Hi, Michelle. Hi, Michelle. That's a bit better. I have been looking today at the other story that's happening politically this week is, of course, discussion around Andrew Broad. Now that we know that the member for Mallee will not recontest the next election, the Nationals Party President Larry Anthony has said today that he thinks that a female candidate would be best placed to win that seat. And he was very direct about who he thinks that should be. He actually said that the deputy leader of the Nationals, Bridget McKenzie, who is currently a senator, should actually run for that seat of Mallee, which would obviously mean she'd have to leave the Senate. Now, there is no word yet on whether that's a reality from the senator herself. Mm-hmm. In fact, she has pointed out today that she's currently been setting up an electoral office in Wodonga, which is the seat of Indi. There has been talk around whether she would be challenging the independent member there, Cathy McGowan, at the next federal election. But just interestingly, if you are in Mildura, which is obviously in Mallee, and you speak to the locals there, this is what they had to say about whether they know who Bridget McKenzie is.
My name's Michael and I'm from Mildura.
Have you heard of Bridget McKenzie, Michael?
No, I haven't.
I haven't heard of her. So if I was to tell you she's a Nationals politician, federal, that wouldn't mean anything to you?
No.
Nope.
Doesn't mean anything. No.
The Nationals have posited as a potential to replace Andrew Broad as a candidate in the upcoming election for the Mallee.
Yep.
Would that mean anything to you?
Yeah, that means something to me now, yes.
Do you think it should be a woman who replaces Andrew Broad as candidate?
No, not necessarily. No, just because one man's, you know, made some wrong decisions doesn't mean that they all will. So, no, I think that's taking it a bit far and a bit, taking the sexism thing too much.
Thank you to Matt Tribe and Simon Gletter for getting those voices from the streets of Mildura today. So I guess whoever it is, Michelle, man or woman, who decides to run in Mallee, they should probably get out on the streets and get people to know them.
Possibly a bit of work to do with brand recognition there. Thank you, Bridget, and thank you for your company this afternoon. You've been listening to Australia Wide.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.